You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 11th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Say I love you.
Wow.
And Evan Bernstein.
Well, I don't think I can top that. I'll just say hi, everyone.
Hey, Evan.
Hello.
Hello.
Is that your little cherub, Jay?
Yes, he was in my lap. I was saying goodnight to him. And just then, my wife just took him away. Oh, my God. I love him. Of course I do. He's epic.
So Rebecca can't be with us this evening. So we'll have to soldier on without her. Evan, you're going to cover this day in skepticism.
I shall. And it was June 14th, 1949. Albert II became the first monkey in space as his flight reached 134 kilometers, which is past the Kármán line, K-A-R-M-A-N, but the A's have, you know, those little accents over the over each of them. That's the line that makes you officially into space. If you cross that line, you are technically in space. And Albert II became the first monkey to do so. Yeah, so before humans went into space, we had to send up some different various animals, obviously, to do testing. And fruit flies were actually the first animals to go up, and they came back intact. Eventually, we got up to monkeys. Albert I was the first monkey, but didn't make it to the threshold of having gone into space, but fortunately also did not survive the trip. Albert II did make it to space. Unfortunately, the parachute failed upon re-entry, and he didn't survive the trip either.
Well, he survived the trip. He just died on impact.
Okay. Yes.
Well, if you want to get technical. Survived,
he survived up to the very end of the trip.
Right.
How about that?
Exactly.
And there was an Albert III, an Albert IV, and Albert V, and they all flew aboard rockets. None survived their flights. They either died on impact or during the flight. You know, but look. These little creatures made a great sacrifice as far as our space ambitions went. And, who you know, look, they probably saved the lives of people. I don't doubt it. So they're little monkey heroes. They had the right monkey stuff, I guess.
Yeah. Nice. Simian stuff. Yeah, most of them were rhesus monkeys, but Albert III was a cynomolgus monkey. You guys know what that is?
I'm unfamiliar with that one.
That's a crab-eating macaque, apparently.
They only eat crabs?
Probably not. It's just like they probably love it more than any other.
Someone should give those guys some butter. They'll freak.
Or bacon. Bacon check.
Albert II flew aboard a V-2 rocket. Remember the V-2 rockets? They were used against the Allies by Hitler's regime in World War II.
So here, crab-eating macaques typically do not consume crabs. They are opportunistic omnivores.
Okay, so
it's amazing how many animals their names are misnomers, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
like the jumbo shrimp.
You know? The jumbo. Exactly. Like the the koala bear is not a bear.
Oh, right.
Right. Yes. The Tasmanian devil is actually a demon. I don't know if you were aware of that.
Oh, okay. There's that.
I thought it was just a demon. Yeah. That's a good one.
The sun bear is not actually a sun.
The cockatoo is not a, well.
Yeah, it kind of speaks for itself.
Yeah. It only has one.
The sloth is actually my ex-wife, so go and figure.
Yeah.
Oh,
boy.
Hey, how you doing out there?
Like jellyfish are not fish.
Oh, yeah. Starfish, not stars. I mean,
also,
not fish.
Also not a fish.
The Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire.
Yeah, not an animal either, but that's okay.
The sucker-footed bat is not a sucker. They're pretty damn smart.
Bob, apparently for the first time ever, someone, or I should say something, has passed the infamous Turing test.
Yes, big news, big news. Claims are being made that finally and officially the Turing test has been passed, in which a software program fools enough people into thinking it's human, which is pretty much what it is. And so all I've got to say about that is that I've never been so disappointed at what was supposed to be a huge milestone in my life that it wasn't. And, so frustrating. But let me go into a little bit of background. The Turing test, if you're not that familiar, was devised by Alan Turing in 1950. Turing was just a true legend in so many fields. artificial intelligence, mathematics, just to scratch the surface. He came up with the fundamental model of computation, the Turing machine that's used in theoretical computer science. He helped crack the Nazi code cipher in World War II. And the list goes on and on.
And then he was persecuted for being gay.
Oh my God, that was horrible. That was horrible.
Committed suicide,
right? One of the great injustices in history.
Yep.
Oh, horrid.
It's actually a little controversial whether it was suicide, but still it was horrific. But he wrote a paper called The Computing Machinery and Intelligence at around that time. And his goal in the paper was to address the question of whether machines can think. And you know, that seems very commonplace now, but 64 years ago, it was quite a thought. He considered the word, thinking to be a very nebulous, word, very hard to define. He kind of was thinking of a way to get a handle on it. He came up initially with the imitation game, which then, eventually evolved into his Turing test. And then that kind of evolved into our modern conception of the Turing test, in which people interact through text, with other humans and machines. And if 30% of the people think a machine is a person, then it passed the Turing test. That's pretty much it. These tests of artificial intelligence, these have happened, many times over the years, many, many times. And invariably the software fails at the test. Occasionally there's a winner. People have been declared a winner. But this time it's different, sort of. It happened on June 7th, which was the 65th anniversary of Turing's death, at the University of Reading in the UK. 30 judges were used, a lot of judges. Now, the key differences in this Turing test that a lot of people are talking about are the fact that this test had the most simultaneous comparison test that have ever been used. And most crucially, though, the really key thing is that the judges could ask anything they wanted. In the past, apparently, a lot of these tests were very strictly limited. You really couldn't talk about anything. It had to be just a finite set of questions that you could ask. And I always thought that really could never even have a real Turing test winner at all if there were restrictions like that on what you could talk about. To me, that seemed more of like some kind of expert system to me rather than an AI. Kind of really defeated the purpose. But ultimately, a program taking on the persona of a 13-year-old Ukrainian boy named Eugene Guzman won the day. He convinced 33% of the judges that he was Pinocchio. I mean, that he was a real boy. And he actually came very close a few years ago at another Turing test. He was 29% or 28, and he just missed it. So the question is, did he really pass the Turing test? Guys, just give me a quick yes or no. Did he pass the Turing test?
No.
Jay?
Wow.
Okay, I'm torn, but I guess I'll say no.
All right. I think it depends how you define it. You could argue that he passed the modern conception of the test. Like I said, it was the real first time that the questions were not limited in any way, which I think is important. But also I think you could maybe more strongly argue that he didn't pass the Turing test in a lot of ways. One of the things that really kind of pissed me off is that pretending to be a 13-year-old boy that's not even a native speaker, to me, that seems very underhanded and kind of like a cheat. You know, that's just...
It's cheating.
It really is. One of the obvious ways that you're going to tell apart a man from a machine is the use of language, right? That's all you really have. So if you let a judge know from the get-go that not only are you this, potentially naive kid, but that you're not even well-spoken. It's not English. It's not even your first language. So that's totally baloney, in my opinion, and is totally against the spirit of the test. But I think it's even worse than that. If you consider the true intent of the test and what Turing most likely had in mind, I think there's just no way that Eugene passed this test. And there's so many reasons. First of all, 30% is lame as hell. That's a ridiculous number. And it's not even real in a way. Turing himself doesn't even seem to have meant 30% to be used that way. He didn't intend that. What he was talking about was that he said that he makes a prediction within 50 years, computers would play the game well enough that an average interrogator will not have more than 70% chance of making the right identification after 5 minutes of questioning. Okay? So that 30% wasn't even really part of the test. That's just part of his prediction. And also he's been quoted as saying later on in his life that he didn't think it would be passed for 100 years. So clearly that 30% is just like kind of pulled out of everyone's butt. And it's kind of ridiculous if you think about it. I mean, if I had to just throw that number out there for the modern Turing test, I would say, come on, it would have to be at least 60 or 70%. So that's a joke. I think the real bottom line here is that Eugene is just a chatbot. It doesn't really understand the questions. What's going on with the conversation? There's no level of thinking going on in any significant level at all. There's not even an animal's level of what we would call consciousness, if you want to use the C word in this context. He's all psychological prestidigitation. He tries to control the conversation and steer it towards interactions that are actually pre-scripted and pre-written. And even his amount of question analysis and parsing, from what I could tell, from what minimal reading of the actual exchanges typical of Eugene are, I think it's very minimal. I was thoroughly unimpressed. And to me, this whole thing was a sideshow. There really was no technological breakthrough here. Clearly nothing that I had been anticipating for decades. It was really kind of a joke. I think, this is, the Turing test was devised decades ago, and it's been kind of tweaked over the years into what it is today. And it's really just not, it's really kind of a joke, and a lot of artificial intelligence researchers, including Marvin Minsky, really think it's a joke. I think we need to really just come up with a new type of Turing test to reflect our more subtle understanding of the mind and intelligence and computer science. For example, just here's one idea. You could have a machine look at a complex image or video and then have that program describe it and answer questions about it and show that they've got some true insight on what's going on in that scene. If you could really understand a scene like that, that would be one aspect of intelligence that I think would be much more valuable than just having a slick chatbot convince you that it's a human and not a machine. And there's lots of different ways that we could really demonstrate it much better than what the Turing test is.
Yeah, this is thoroughly underwhelming. I mean, this is a chatbot that eked over this one iteration of the Turing test. But Bob, the thing, listening to your discussion about this, the problem I'm having is that you're using, I kind of know the definition of the terms that you're going with, but those definitions need to be explored in order to even know what the hell we're talking about here. So like AI, artificial intelligence, what do you mean by that? Are you assuming that AI is self-awareness? Is consciousness, is thinking?
Well, that's what I meant by this many different types of intelligence. And clearly, I think the spirit of the Turing test, to me, I've always interpreted as some level of consciousness and understanding and human-like thinking. But that's kind of a hubris, though, really. I mean, that's a human-level intelligence that we're talking about. But there's lots of other different types of intelligence, and not necessarily, that doesn't mean that ones that aren't human-like aren't valuable.
But Bob, that's not what the Turing test really ever was designed to do. The Turing test cannot tell if the machine is actually thinking or abstracting or understanding. It's only judging based upon the output. Is the output indistinguishable from a human? And you're trying to infer from that whether or not it's actually thinking and abstracting, but that's only as good as the tester.
And that's a big problem I have with a lot of this. I think these judges, some of them didn't really seem too qualified to actually judge.
Yeah,
and 5 minutes isn't a long enough time. I liked how it was unrestricted questioning. But right, I mean, Steve, but I think if you could pull off a program that really can survive a really deep grilling, I mean, you could even accomplish a lot in 5 minutes. I think that would go a long way to making the argument that there's some level of conscious thought going on there.
Well, Bob, that's the big question. This is what I consider to be the most interesting question in here. Let me back up for a little bit. So first, I think we need to distinguish between two types of computing here, or two types of artificial intelligence. The type that we have now, and that all of this is dealing with, are top-down expert systems that are using brute force in order to simulate interaction. They're not even on the track to becoming a true self-aware,
exactly,
conscious
totally
entities.
Agree.
Yeah. The other type of artificial intelligence, what you're seem to be talking about at times, is something that is actually built to think and to understand and to comprehend and has some kind of awareness. The question is, can you brute force a top-down chatbot or something, or expert system or something equivalent? Can that ever get to the point that it will be indistinguishable from a human being, even under open-ended, expert, unlimited grilling? And that, I don't know the answer to that question.
How can you not know the answer, though, Steve? I mean, eventually, no. I mean, as computers get smarter and faster.
Yeah, but the question is, will you ever get to a level of complexity with a top-down algorithm that will be able to really be indistinguishable from a human that has actual abstraction and understanding? Or will you always be able to eventually push it beyond its limits? Right? Because no matter how brute force an algorithm you use, it's never infinite. It could never be infinite. The problem is that our brains, the way they function, they're capable of almost, you know, limitless types of analysis and pattern recognition and abstraction and thinking, you know, and it's like trying to predict the weather in a way, in that once you, it's like chaos theory, right? It's like, once you get past a certain level, that you just can't brute force your way through it anymore. I think that we may run into inherent limitations in the top-down brute force method, and that we'll never be able to truly pass a Turing test. I mean, one where you have, again, expert unlimited grilling, and we may need to shift to bottom-up, truly abstracting thinking types of software or machines before we'll ever get to that level. Okay, that's the question. But having said that, so far, if you look historically, we've assumed that you would need like human level true AI in order to be able to accomplish certain things, like being a chess master, when clearly you don't. A top down bot can use an algorithm and brute force to beat a chess master. So you don't need actual AI to do that.
Right. So chess is clearly amenable to that type of brute force.
Yeah.
But is human intelligence. You know, you're right, Steve. I agree that we really don't know if it's doable. It might be impossible. We could potentially eventually pull it off in such a way that it is extremely, extremely difficult, you know, to determine whether that's a machine or not. I think that might be possible. But then you kind of tiptoe into the idea though of the qualia, that experience, that indefinable experience. Would it really truly be conscious, or would it be just a pure imitation machine that really has no true self-awareness?
So now you're getting into a P-zombie debate. Yeah,
that's a different level.
Yeah, but Bob, that's a totally different thing. Yeah.
That's what we call a P-zombie, a philosophical zombie, which
I remember we talked about that, but I think that's a valid concern. So my point is that we may be able to produce one that's very, very believable, but still not have that.
Yeah.
You know, it's still not have what it takes to be conscious and self-aware. I mean,
that's
possible.
The question. And that's what I hope I live long enough to see, because I want to know if we can use a top-down algorithm-based brute force system to like really, really imitate human intelligence.
Steve, you just reminded me of that Star Trek episode. That was the equation.
Yes, that was it. Or do you need to build in functionality that basically would make it a self-aware thinking machine?
I think that's clearly the way to go. I think it's valuable. We could try both methods, because there'd be plenty of payoff from a brute force. Absolutely. But yeah, I don't think we're going to achieve that until we try the bottom-up approach.
All right. We're not going to solve this problem tonight. So, Evan, we always like talking about psychic fails, and there were a couple of worthy mentions recently in the last few weeks.
Yeah. Hey, do you guys remember that James Randi once received a comment, and he so graciously shared it with the rest of us in his entire community? The comment was that mediums are aptly named because they are neither rare nor well done.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very...
That's fun. It's a very... Awesome. I love that. I just love it.
Yeah, awesome. As did... It was from an old Swift newsletter from, you know, like 2004 or something. So, and he didn't, I don't recall who, but he said it wasn't his quote. He attributed it to somebody else, and he said he wished he had thought of that. And that's a nice simple way of summing up psychics. They're everywhere, right? So that they're neither rare, right? Big names, small names, world celebrities, the tarot card reader down the road. I mean, they're everywhere. You can't walk down the street without running into one. And additionally, at the same time, they're not well done. They are the most unimpressive lot of fakers, charlatans, and or reality challenge people that I think you might ever want to meet. But tonight, we're going to honor both their prolific nature and lack of claimed abilities by talking about these two news items involving psychics. And back in May, there's a popular British psychic named Sally Morgan. Is her name. I'm told she's popular. I know, you know, in Britain, I suppose. And she's performing one of her usual shows in a town called Middlesbrough in the United Kingdom. But unlike countless other performances by Sally over her long career, years of doing her shtick, something extraordinary actually did happen that night. So here's what happened. Sally failed so miserably that she actually wound up convincing people that she had no real psychic abilities whatsoever.
No, really? Like people came to the conclusion that she can't do. Oh my God. She had to do so bad that night. It must have been an epic fail.
The audience turned on her, and it was one of the most epic fails I've ever read about involving a psychic. But that's only half the victory, I think, for the night. The other half, for which we may not have ever known that this actually happened, was that gentleman by the name of Miles Power. He was in the audience that night. Miles is one of the co-hosts of the podcast called The League of Nerds, and he runs his own website called milespower.co.uk. He's a chemist by day and a skeptical activist by night.
Oh, he's got a superpower.
Don't we all? Think about it. Like, if someone in our community had not been there to witness the epic failure by Psychic Sally, the general public may actually never have learned what had happened that night, right? There's no known recordings of the events of that evening. I checked with Miles, and he was unaware of any cameras. He was there, but he's unaware of any cameras that were set up, or he didn't see anybody holding up their cell phones and, you know, doing any obvious recording of the evening. And although most people left more skeptical than those who had arrived, because he was there, the whole world now knows that Sally so badly failed. It got picked up everywhere. His blog post about this night went national and international, all over the intertubes. And here's how it went down. So part of Psychic Sally's act is that she asks the audience members to bring in pictures of loved ones who had died. And Sally takes the pictures, and just by holding the picture, she claims she's able to communicate with them in the afterlife. Sally takes one of these pictures, right? And here's how Miles described it. I'm taking this from his blog post. She held the picture up to the camera, and it was projected on the large screen behind her. The picture was of a middle-aged woman, and by the clothes she was wearing and the quality of the image, I guessed it was taken somewhere in the 1990s. So this is where Sally started doing the typical cold reading guessing game, right? Throwing out random names of people to see if anyone in the audience would bite, but initially nobody did. And Miles continues in his blog post. He said that Sally asked the person who submitted the photo, and please stand up. So a rather small, chunky woman at the center of the hall stood up, and Sally once again began to get messages from the afterlife, right? Sally then became in direct contact with the woman in the photo and began to tell her that there was lots of confusion around her death. She felt it was very quick. She went very quickly. She later went on to say that she has a specific link to her death and that she either died on a Wednesday or was taken ill that day. And so you got this, the woman in the audience standing up was not responding to anything Sally was saying. And she decided to ask how the woman in the photo was related to her. Well, guess what? It turns out the woman in the audience got the whole concept of submitting a picture of someone you wanted to talk to from the afterlife completely wrong. And for some unknown reason, she submitted a younger picture of herself.
Wow.
So she didn't realize that she was dead, huh?
Gee, funny that. Yeah.
It's like a Twilight Zone episode.
Miles described the whole audience roaring in laughter at that point. And basically the audience was lost, right?
Yeah, she lost the audience at that point. Yeah.
Lost the audience. The number of missed guesses by Sally increased quite a bit. The audience was more restrained when they were asked questions. They weren't buying into the whole routine. And the whole air of the night turned from kind of this dazzled audience to something very cold and uncomfortable that evening. So basically, one skeptic can make a difference. As much as the audience was left disappointed and dissatisfied, thanks to Miles's report on this, It caught national and international attention, and we have a lot to talk about now in regards to Psychic Sally and her epic fail.
Unfortunately, these psychics individually and as a profession can survive these epic fails because it just doesn't matter. You know, evidence just doesn't matter for people who want to believe.
An unsinkable rubber duck?
Yeah.
Is that what we call them?
It's still good. Maybe it marginalizes them a little, but who knows?
I think she took a massive hit, though.
Yeah, I think a pop-off. Guy came back.
Yeah.
You know, after being exposed as a fraud.
And obviously, Sally will go on and continue to do this. She's not ruffled by it. She did have her lawyers contact Miles to say that his take on events that evening was incorrect. And he actually forced them to take down their episode of that League of Nerds, but it's actually been gone back up under sort of a different title, back up on YouTube. They claim that Miles used her picture without permission. So that was basically a legal tactic. But in any case, look, the people in that audience that night left more skeptical than when they came in. That's a win. Right. Even 100, 200 people, whatever it was in the audience. Okay. So that at least that one night we have perhaps a few less gullible people in the world. The other big psychic news from recent days is closer to home. Long Island, New York. Precisely. There's an official investigation into Teresa Caputo, better known as the Long Island Medium, which is the name of her hit cable television show. Very popular in America, travels also the country and does television, radio, you know, all over the place. She's, you know, very popular.
She's terrible. Ever watch her? She's horrible. She does terrible cold readings. She misses terrible. All over the place. She was on Dr. Oz. Did you guys catch that episode? It was embarrassing.
Oh, I missed that.
It was embarrassing for both of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Radar Online picked up this story and ran with it, and it's also making national and international headlines. The gentleman who runs the website scifake.com, his name is Ron Tebow. He is conducting a private investigation into Teresa's antics. She's in discussions with people who have been associated with Teresa for quite some time. Apparently some people who have some dirt on her from the inside. And he's also speaking to people who want to file complaints against her, feeling that she's absolutely a fraud. You know, they feel taken. They feel like they did not get what they were promised, either by attending her show, investing in one of her, you know, private readings or whatnot. And he's in the process of gathering information, people coming forward to put together a case, a civil suit against her for fraud. Here's what he says. He says she schmoozes with the audience, wins them over with her big hair, designer shoes, and comedy. And when they trust her, that's when she goes in for the kill. She'll ask the group a question like, who lost an older male relative to heart problems? And it's the oldest trick in the medium's book. Yes, we do know that. We are familiar with those kinds of tactics. That's exactly what she does. But Steve, as you said, she's horribly, horribly unimpressive. Really, one of the worst cold readers out there. It's her shtick. That's why she has a television show. It's her whole, you know, it's the woman from Long Island. It's the accent. It's the clothes and everything like he described. Now, there's some people who think that there's a problem here with this particular case that he's trying to bring, in that you can get as many people as you want to give testimonials and get some inside dirt and so forth. But is there a way that you can prove that what she's doing, she knows for sure that she is a fraud and is willingly defrauding people by using this technique. That's different. That's a lot harder to prove.
Yeah.
And they say, Ron Tebow here, the scifake.com website, has a long way to go, in this investigation. And he's going to have to come up with some things that are pretty ironclad and solid. And, you know, testimonials and customer complaints just aren't going to be enough.
It's an interesting tactic. I'd like to see how it plays out. You know, there's too many variables to really say, you know.
Yeah.
Like if they have evidence of her actually like doing hot readings, getting direct information from audience members, then pretending to psychically feed it back to them, that could go somewhere. That could have legs.
Yeah, that's definitely, you know, that's not just like a stage show at that point. That's scamming those people deliberately.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of my thoughts about this is that if they pursue this and they wind up failing in the end, what if Teresa comes out, you know, squeaky clean in a sense on the other side? If she were to survive going through that kind of lawsuit. Would that therefore elevate her to a level that she certainly, you know, does not deserve, right? I fought off my critics. I proved myself in court. She would use that to her greatest advantage
backfire,
and try
to.
So there's real risk here.
All right. Thanks, Evan. So, guys, have you ever heard of the planet Thea?
Theopolis? Yeah, I have. That's the one that hit the Earth.
Which Star Trek episode was it? I'm trying to remember.
That's the hypothetical planet, Mars-sized planet, that smacked into the Earth 4.5 billion years ago, resulting in Earth 2 and the Moon, basically the Earth-Moon system that we have today. What's interesting, so there's been an update on this whole, the hypothesis, the impact hypothesis of the moon formation. There was actually a bit of missing information or data about that hypothesis that I wasn't aware of. So, you guys are aware of isotopes, right?
Yes.
Isotope is different isotopes of an element have different numbers of neutrons. Yes, so an element is defined by how many protons it has. Typically, like oxygen has 8 protons. The most common isotope of oxygen also has 8 neutrons. That would be O16. But there are less common isotopes, including oxygen with 9 neutrons, O17, or 10 neutrons, O18. Isotopic ratios, like the ratio of the different isotopes of oxygen, for example, are very useful in knowing where something came from. So like if we have a meteorite, and we could look at the isotopic ratio of this stuff in the meteorite, and we could tell whether or not that meteorite came from the asteroid belt, the moon, or Mars, right? We could tell where it came from.
How accurate is that?
Extremely. It's very reliable. Once we know the isotopic ratios of like Mars rocks, then we could identify rocks from Mars.
So there's no other isotopes the same as Mars. If it's this specific isotope, it had to have come from Mars.
Well, that's the question. The theory is that rocks and planets and planetoids and stuff that forms in different parts of the solar system at different distances from the sun because of whatever, the solar wind, the density of the cloud at the time, whatever, due to different factors, that resulted in these different isotopic ratio signatures for that region of the solar system. So the Earth, therefore, has a different isotopic signature than Mars and from the moons of Jupiter or whatever, the asteroid belt, whatever. One limitation of that, though, is that we do not have any rocks from Mercury or Venus. So we don't know if they're the same or different, for example, from Earth. Maybe the inner solar system all has the same isotopic signature, like within Mars. We know that the Earth is different than Mars. We don't know about Mercury and Venus. Okay. Now we go back to Thea, this Mars-sized planet that smacked into the Earth 4.5 billion years ago. So that was a different planet. That should have a different isotopic signature than the Earth.
Meaning that there should be rock on Earth that isn't matching all the other rock?
This is where it gets complicated. If Thea smacked into the Earth and threw up a bunch of material from itself and the Earth into orbit, and that eventually coalesced into the moon, then obviously some of the planet would be left behind on Earth and some would be in the moon. And then we need, you know, computer modeling to try to figure out like, well, how much of the moon, therefore, would be Thea and how much would be Earth? And the estimates are that the moon should be between 70 and 90% Thea and only 10 to 30% Earth. But the moon rocks have the same isotopic signature as Earth.
Wow.
So that's the one piece. I don't think it's the only piece, but it was one significant piece to the impact hypothesis that just wasn't fitting. One possibility is that it's because, well, maybe Thea also came from the inner solar system and maybe it has the same signature as Earth.
That's what I would think.
That's one possibility, for example. And that could be true. And if it is true, like if we get rock from Venus and it has the same isotopic signature as Earth, then the problem goes away, right?
Get your ass to Venus.
Yeah.
Well, we got to get to Venus.
Well, there was a study published recently. We have not gotten to Venus or Mercury, but researchers using a more, just basically better technology, a more sophisticated machine to detect oxygen isotopic ratios in 3 separate moon rocks brought back by the Apollo missions, you know, the ones that never actually went to the moon because it's all a big conspiracy.
Oh, that's right.
So they looked at these moon rocks and they found that, in fact, they have a different isotopic ratio than the Earth.
How'd they miss that?
Because it's a very tiny difference. And it was just missed by the earlier machines that didn't have the resolution to pick up the small difference. So, for example, their 0.017 to 0.016 ratio was 12 parts per million higher than rocks derived from Earth's mantle. So if that difference is real and holds up, it suggests that the moon is at least partly made out of material that's a little bit different than Earth, and therefore that could support the impact hypothesis. I wouldn't go so far as to saying, as many news outlets did, of course, that this proves the impact hypothesis, but it certainly is potentially an answer to this one nagging problem that wasn't fitting. Where do we need to go from here? Well, we need more moon rocks. We need to test this ratio. Also, it would be nice if we could test deeper moon rocks. Perhaps, for example, the rocks exposed on the surface of the moon are a little bit different than the Earth because, well, they've been changed over the last 4 billion years from, you know, micrometeorites, solar wind, stuff that stuff that we're shielded from on the Earth because of our atmosphere.
Steve, so are you suggesting that we should blow up the moon?
Yeah, right. Well, maybe we might need to get Bruce Willis to drill down underneath the surface of the moon and get us some moon rocks.
I wonder how. So
is there anything he can't do?
Did we ever drill into the moon? Like, did we ever go just past the very topmost regolith?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. No.
What about digging? I guess only 10 or 20% of the Earth would be different. It'll be kind of tough to find that.
Yeah.
Well, we could smash something into the moon, right, and create our own crater. Or
we've done that. Get down. We've done that, but we haven't brought back rocks from the impact. We just did it to like look at the dust and see what was in there.
We can only measure that isotope by bringing it back. We can't.
So far,
we don't have sophisticated enough equipment to make a long distance analysis.
Nope.
That's unfortunate.
Nope. Not with this resolution. No, we need to bring it back.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So unanswered questions: is this ratio would a more thorough survey of different rocks from different locations on the moon support this ratio? Do Mercury and Venus have the same or different isotopic signatures than the Earth? And how do different impact models affect the ratio of Earth to Theia in the composition of the moon?
And does Bigfoot like 70s music? I mean, nobody knows.
That's completely unknown. Yeah. But this analysis also suggests that the moon might be a 50-50 mix of Earth and Theia, which is a little off from the computer models, but I don't see that as a deal killer. So it's interesting. What I like about reading this is this is one of those completely, like, there's no emotional, political, social, controversy here. It's just a pure scientific question. And to have scientists, like, look at it from every possible angle, offer every possible alternative hypothesis, and figure out, like, what evidence do we need to figure out if it's this or is it that, you know?
Yeah. What's it's just the a mix? Scientific discussion using the latest information.
Yeah. And being completely skeptical and exploring every possibility and deciding based upon evidence. It's just a really good story about how science is supposed to work, especially just removed from any kind of ridiculous controversy.
Yeah, no drama.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Pretty cool. All right, Jay, but even cooler, maybe, is SpaceX's announcement of their new launch vehicle.
Yeah, it's cooler in a different way.
Yeah, a different way.
This is the latest vehicle that SpaceX has made. It's called the Dragon version 2 or Dragon B2, and the unveiling was very recent. They unveiled it on May 29th. There's been a lot of a lot of hype before it came out, of course, and a lot of people excited. I saw some early images, and I got to tell you, it really did live up to my hopes and expectations. So check out the baseline information. Now we're talking about a capsule that, of course, will be sent up on a rocket. It will dock with various spacecraft or space stations in outer space, and then it'll come back to Earth. So this is really the capsule that the astronauts are in. Now, this particular capsule can do a lot of things, and it has a lot of technology that we've never even seen before. And one of them, and quite the most impressive, is that this thing can, when it comes back into the Earth's atmosphere, it has two ways of landing. One way is it could use parachutes, but it'll only use parachutes if there is massive engine failure, because it has four engines that will help it land back on Earth. And it lands like a, guys, like really a 50s a 40s and 50s sci-fi rocket. Like, it goes up on a rocket and it comes down powered by its own rockets and it lands itself. And it, you know, the feet come out at the bottom and it lands. That is so freaking cool.
That was very cool to see the simulation.
Wasn't it? I know. I watched it a dozen times. It was awesome.
Yeah.
So, like Evan just said, there is animation about the whole thing works. So here's how it goes. It shows the aircraft in orbit and it has a secondary stage on it that has solar panels and it's flying to, say, the ISS. It docks, but it docks in a new way. Now, most spacecraft or all spacecraft have to be brought to the ISS with the arm. What this does is the nose opens up and it'll be able to dock itself without the use of the arm. Very cool, very, very elegant, and very smart, right? Of course, we want ships that don't need to be slowly brought in by the arm. We want something that could do it on its own. So they show the capsule decoupling from its second stage, or whatever you want to call the thing it was carrying with it. It was really like a solar array collector. It goes up to the ISS, it docks, then it slowly undocks. You know, I'm sure that, you know, lots of things would happen in between those two, people getting on and off, cargo being moved around. Now the astronauts are back in the capsule and they're going back. So it slowly moves away. It's back in orbit. It starts to deorbit. It does all the things that you'd expect a capsule to do. It turns, you know, the egg-shaped belly down. The heat shield is like, I think it's their version 3 of their heat shield, which is dramatically improved. It does its descent. This is going to be a descent I'm going to describe where it just uses the gear, not the parachutes. So then when it gets to a particular altitude, and I'm just judging from the animation, I would say that it was, you know, maybe it's 60,000 feet. It was really high up there. The engines turn on. It starts to slow itself down. And as it gets near the surface, it slows down enough where it literally could just do a one touch down and it's done. It lands all by itself. Very awesome. Very impressive. The capsule can also land, like I said, with parachutes, but that is only going to be engaged if there's engine error. And it can land, guys, with half of its landing engines. I believe it has four.
Wow.
So it can land with two of the engines functioning.
I love how redundant those systems are.
Exactly.
It's so safe, yep.
Now, check this out, Bob.
Yeah.
They can refuel it and send it right back up.
Really?
Yes, the reusability is extraordinarily high on this. That was part of the design. And, you know, one of the things that Elon Musk said at the end of the video, that the reveal video, was the, you know, incredible cost of taking a ship and either like half of it gets dumped in the ocean. And then, you know, even like a capsule, they just throw it away or put it in a museum. The reusability, you know, even with the space shuttle, they had to pretty much, you know, re-outfit the whole space shuttle.
Oh, my God, yeah.
They had to replace a lot of the tiles. They probably did a significant rebuilding of all the engines and everything. I mean, it just popped. I know that the space shuttle in and of itself is a powered vehicle, but you know, the two are really, I'd have to argue that they're too dissimilar to make a one-to-one comparison. But the idea here is you just strap this thing back onto another rocket and send it back up, and the turnaround could be, from his description, like fast, like really fast.
Yeah, because the blade of heat shield, I think, would last for 10 re-entries. So every 10 flights, you have to replace it. So, yeah, all they got to do is refuel it and send it back up, which is awesome.
Yep, it has 18 maneuvering thrusters that are used in outer space and in orienting the ship on re-entry, which is very cool. Like, they're using the same thrusters for both outer space and an atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
The capsule is equipped with Super Draco engines. Evan.
Draco.
16,000 pounds of thrust for each one of these engines. Again, they overbuilt it, and the rocket engines, hold on to yourself, guys. This blew my mind. Mm. They're printed. The engines are printed.
What?
They're printed, yeah.
They're printed.
No way.
Say it, Bob.
Come
Say
on.
It. The engines are printed. I can't believe
Holy
they're printing rocket
crap.
Engines.
Jay, I believe there are four pairs of engines, so there are actually eight.
Oh, you mean the re-entry engines?
The descent engines, yeah, the ones that they use to land.
Yeah, so those Super Draco engines are the engines that they use for re-entry, and they're incredibly powerful. And he also showed during the reveal the fuel capsule and how easy it is to refuel and how quickly the refueling is. And he mentioned, you know, like what type of fuel cells they are and everything. And it's all brand new technology. inside the capsule, guys. I'm sure you've seen the pictures. Just utterly amazing. It was very lean. It wasn't cluttered. It was very, it just had a real sci-fi look to it. You know, the,
smooth and sleek.
Yeah. They had touch screens with, you know, not a huge number of actual buttons in there, which I guess is a better system. I'm just imagine it's more versatile, probably a lot less wiring and all that. The seats and inner design are just gorgeous. Like I'm fully impressed about every decision that they made. There's a really cool, it's not diamond plating, but there's some type of design in the metal on the inside that just is provocative and really, really cool looking. So overall, this is a massive success if all the technology does end up matching what I heard and what I read about it. And I'm sure it does because of how heavily they've tested the capsule. It's cool looking on the outside as well. It's everything about it is a positive. I didn't get when it was going to be used. I don't know how quickly they're going to deploy it. I'm sure that because they revealed it, that this is coming or even scheduled.
No, I think they're saying that its first flight will probably be something around 2017.
Oh, really? That many years out? So I guess they have a lot more testing to do.
Look, they got a lot of testing to do.
That's only 3 years. That's not too bad.
On to the next item, which is somewhat related to this, but Dr. Harold Sunny, which is his nickname, Dr. Harold White, is working in future propulsion solutions for interplanetary travel. I'm sure you guys have heard this and seen the pictures. This is a scientist that's working for NASA, and he says that they are working on a FTL, or faster than light travel, using the Alcubierre drive concept. I'm sure I mispronounced that. This is a theory that was created by a theoretical physicist named Miguel Alcubierre, and it's based on Einstein's field equations in general relativity. The scientists that are developing this say that a ship that uses this kind of warp drive bends the space around it. I don't know how. I tried to find more information. I was just hoping that Bob might have something to add here. But it makes the actual distance shorter. So it warps space and it compresses the distance, or just simply makes the distance shorter. So when it gets up to a very fast speed, it's moving faster than the speed of light if you're actually judging the raw distance. How about that?
Yeah, it's cool. What I like about this is that it makes a serious attempt to play with modern physics well. You know, there's nothing so egregious that you want to run away screaming. But if this works, it'd be great. But if it's possible, this isn't going to happen within our lifetimes. The idea is that it uses negative energy to compress the space in front of it and then expand the space behind it. And the ship is in a warped bubble of space, and you just kind of ride this wave, and you could exceed the speed of light because it's really just the fabric. It's really just space-time that's doing the moving, and you're not really moving at all. And you can't move faster within your warp bubble because you still need to obey that. But if space itself is moving, then you can exceed it. And that's possible. But I mean, they're talking about huge amounts of energy. Initially they had said that you would need the equivalent energy of Jupiter, converting Jupiter.
And that's clearly wacky.
But now they're saying it's less.
The images of it are so cool.
The ship design is beautiful.
Right?
They made it
look like Star Trek.
I want a model. They named it Enterprise. What was it? XS1 Enterprise. I mean, it's beautiful. But now they're saying that they have a new design for the bubble where it wouldn't have to be that energy intensive, that it would be just the equivalent of, say Voyager 1. But if you converted Voyager 1 into energy, you're talking like 700,000, Hiroshima bombs. I mean, still a tremendous, tremendous amount of energy. And there's other issues. You'd have to somehow move the negative energy in front of the ship. And that could be impossible because the energy might need to travel faster than light. Also, there was some research saying that, as the ship travels, it would gather, radiation and energy, cosmic energy, and that it would then release when you came out of warp drive. So basically you get at your destination and it would explode, type of thing.
You're just a negative Danny, Bob. I'm sick of your negativity. I want this ship now.
Dude,
come on. Proof of concept. Let's go.
Multiply how much you want at times 10. That's how much I want. I'm just trying to be real.
All right. Well, Dr. White,
you don't want to be the first one to go.
The lead scientist is actually working on proving everything out that Bob described at NASA's Eagle Works, and that's at the Johnson Space Center. Dr. White is looking for these things, like microscopic real-world warp bubbles that are theoretically believed to exist, and they're using an instrument called a White Juday, J-U-D-A-Y, warp field interferometer.
Happy Juday.
White Juday. Yeah, warp field interferometer.
Now they're making stuff up. Okay.
If his work is successful, he says that he'd be able to create an engine that will get us to Alpha Centauri in 2 weeks, as measured by the clocks here on Earth. That's what he said, Evan. What am I saying? I agree with Bob.
Well, okay. Looks good on paper.
This isn't a theoretical stage. This is not even engineering. This is just doing calculations to see what the physics would be like.
And somebody has
to do
it.
The model of the ship is just purely for fun. I mean, you know what I mean? I don't know that it's any relationship to, like, they're not engineering this ship. You know what I mean?
Steve, it's actually, I don't disagree with them having fun coming up with
this. No, absolutely. It's gorgeous. I love the design.
But it's also good for inspiration. I mean, let's face it, guys. A lot of innovation comes from inspiration. So you need people to get excited. We need, you know, more money to flow. I mean, his budget is so tiny compared to NASA's budget. And NASA's budget is way too tiny, right? So we're not talking about, he's not spending a lot of money, but we want people to think like this. We've got to think big, think out of the box, and try crazy stuff because sometimes we hit.
Where are the photon torpedoes going?
Yeah, right. Now, listen, I do have to say this, though. If they build that freaking ship, man, just copy the Enterprise bridge. That's it. Just do that. We got Science Bay, Communications Bay.
TNG, Next Generation.
Navigation, done. I got it. You got to have the red light. You got to have the dramatic lighting.
Yeah, but leave off the solar flare generator.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Jay.
I want a quickie with Bob.
Ooh.
What?
Yeah, let's do it, Bob.
What?
Oh, wow.
I'll be in the other
Jay,
room.
I'm so excited. Thank you, Jay. This
Don't
this
get too
is
excited.
This is your quickie with Bob. And this week I'm going to talk about astronomers finding the smallest star ever found and possibly the smallest star possible. The name of this guy is a beautiful name. I love it. 2-mass J05233822140302. Isn't that awesome?
Rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, it does. I'm just going to call it Tyrion. It's 1/8,000th the brightness of the sun, 8,000th, with a temperature of 1800 degrees Celsius. That's about a third.
Jeez.
A third as hot as our sun. The diameter is also just 9% of the sun, meaning that it's smaller than Jupiter, which is kind of amazing. And obviously it's denser. Otherwise the fusion just wouldn't even happen. So it's not that crazy when you think about it. The real cool thing, though, is that it may be at the limit in terms of smallness for a star. It's just crazy small. And if you want some really good details, definitely check out Phil Plait's excellent blog about it on slate.com. He does a fantastic treatment of it as usual. This thing is so tiny, actually, that if it was just a notch tinier, it wouldn't even be a star. It'd just be a brown dwarf. So they really think that it just crossed that threshold of becoming a star. And find out why. The reason is really interesting. There's an unusual relationship between the temperature and mass and size of a star. That's kind of counterintuitive, you know, between a star and non-stars like brown dwarfs. So, and finally, it's so small.
How small is it?
Finally, it's so small that it's so dim that it fuses hydrogen so incredibly slowly that it could potentially live for hundreds of billions, if not trillions of years. It could have just an amazing, amazing lifespan, which is so fun because supergiant stars can live, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years, and they have so much more mass, but they just go through it so insanely quick. So that's all I got. Check out Phil's blog if you want details about it. Fascinating story. This has been your quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you too.
Hey,
yeah,
Bob.
So stars are like light bulbs. The dimmer they are, the longer they last.
Yeah.
All right.
Evan, time for Who's That Noisy?
Thanks, Steve. I'll play for you last week's Who's That Noisy? A little musical composition for you all, if you recall. Here we go.
Yeah, right. Evan, I hope those birds in the background are something funny about that because they just crack me up.
Well, the birds in the background should give you an indication that this was probably recorded at a place where there are animals around, you know, birds among them. But what the heck was making that noise, or what was playing that keyboard?
A monkey?
Something? Someone who just sat down on it or something? Or a plane? No, it is a river otter, or river otters, I should say. Mm.
Now, does he know he's playing the piano, or are they just making him walk on, like, piano-like things?
No, what they did is they put the Casio keyboard up against its cage, and the otters are reaching their hands through, and they are actually pressing the keys with their paws and their arms.
That is adorable. Is there video?
Oh, there is video, and it is adorable, and it is making all the rounds on the internet in the last week or so, and that's why there were so many correct answers this week, but yeah. it was just too cute not to share, I think. And, you know, animals are cool. So yeah, real quick background on this. The National Zoo recently gave a band of Asian small-clawed river otters an electric keyboard to muck around with. And, that's,
they're from Africa and they have big claws, actually.
Oh, well, there you go. So why do they call them Asians? you got me there.
I just watched the video.
You got me.
One of the videos. There's one of them that actually has both his paws through the grate, right? Because it's like a pretty much, it's a crisscross grate.
Yep.
And he's got both his hands through it, and he's playing it like a real keyboardist. And he's like, come on, he's enjoying himself.
You could tell. You can tell that, yeah, they're getting a kick out of it. Definitely. So, you know, it's, you know, clever, I think. You know, give an animal a toy or whatever, see what it'll do with it. And you just never know. Not surprising all that much, but you know, just, it's cool and really, really cute. Again, we knew a lot of people would get this one correctly. It is making the rounds, but there's only one winner each week. This week's winner is Enrique Bustamante. Congratulations, Enrique.
Enrique!
Hope to see you at the end of the year in the final drawing, and you might be joining us for an episode of Science or Fiction. Let's see what happens in early 2015. Wow. Half the year is almost over. It's hard to believe. Okie doke. So, moving on. Brand new Who's That Noisy for this week. This one is not otters, I can guarantee you that. It is a voice. A voice. Perhaps from the past, perhaps from the future. Who knows? Let's find out. Here we go.
I don't eat anything that's, you know, junk food, like processed, horrible chemicals, and I try to eat as organically as possible.
Yep. No chemicals. There's no chemicals in any food that this person eats, apparently. We'll reveal it next week, but we would love your guess. I think you've got some thoughts on this one. WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the official email for Who's That Noisy guesses and submissions. Or go ahead and put it on our forums, sguforums.com. Look for the subforum called Who's That Noisy. Each week I enter a little post there, and you can go ahead and leave it there as well. I check that. I wanted to give out a quick credit to our listener, Bimo Seponin from Japan, who several weeks ago, we had played that alpaca, the alpaca's mating noisy, and I had that was submitted by Bimo back in 2012. So I wanted to make sure that he got proper credit for that. So thank you for that. And of course, as I say every week, and I will continue to say, good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan. All right, let's go to the emails. I don't know how many we're going to get through today. Let's see. First one comes from Rick Reese in Boston. And Rick, not Rick Ross, don't get confused. And he writes, non-science efforts, alternative med and now here religion, create their own journals because they can't publish in real journals and then promote this absolute crap. I can hear Jay absolutely losing his mind about this, which paradoxically is helping me to keep mine. Then he gives a link to a journal article and says that this is just the worst. So the journal is The Journal of Religion and Health. The article, published June 2014, by a Kamal Irmak. Kamal Irmak is entitled Schizophrenia or Possession? He says, demonic possession can manifest with a range of bizarre behaviors, which could be interpreted as a number of different psychotic disorders with delusions and hallucinations. The hallucination in schizophrenia may therefore be an illusion, a false interpretation of a real sensory image formed by demons. A local faith healer in our region helps the patients with schizophrenia. His method of treatment seems to be successful because his patients become symptom-free after 3 months. Therefore, it would be useful for medical professions to work together with faith healers to define better treatment pathways for schizophrenia.
This might as well have been written in 1538.
What utter drivel. This is absolutely horrific and dangerous. And this is not the first time I've encountered this claim that people who are schizophrenic really are possessed by demons.
That's great. Let's
replace our modern psychiatric neuroscientific understanding of mental illness with medieval superstition.
Therefore, these poor people won't get real treatment. They'll get laying of hands or whatever from some religion or some such, right? So, yeah, that's a real great way to go down, you know, with poor these people that are so screwed up that they think that they're possessed.
Jay, don't lose your mind. Worse than that, though, Jay. It's worse than that because the absolute worst thing you could do to somebody who has a delusional disorder is reinforce their delusions.
Right.
So they're not only being treated with hocus pocus instead of actual medicine, they are being told your delusions are real. You know, those voices you're hearing in your head are not a symptom of an illness that needs to be treated. It's demons. You know, imagine that.
Gee, and how does one, let's see, what's the treatment for demonic possession? Oh, exorcism. Gee,
I totally don't buy this claim in the abstract of the article here that this guy is healing these patients, that they're symptom free. What happens is when these cases have been examined, you know, where you take somebody who almost certainly has schizophrenia. I mean, they meet the diagnosis of schizophrenia and they believe that they've incorporated their families or their religious belief system into their delusions, which is common. And they believe they're possessed by demons. If you do an exorcism on them because they're role playing being possessed by a demon, they'll not be possessed by a demon for a time, but then they have, you know, 100% relapse rate.
Yeah, repossession.
Because they're still schizophrenic. So there's at best a temporary change in their behavior because they're playing along with the script of the demonic possession that they believe that they have. For a little background, just because in case there's any confusion out there, so schizophrenia, the word schizophrenia does not refer to split personality. I don't know how that got into the lay public, the vernacular. It's not true. Schizophrenia is it's a neurological disorder. It's a disorder of the brain, in which, people have chronic delusions. They have fixed beliefs that are separate from reality and can't be changed with evidence. And it's characterized by hallucinations, both either auditory or visual. They hear and see things that aren't there. They believe that they're real often, and in fact that if they have auditory hallucinations, they believe that they have a special significance for them, right? That it's directed at them. It's somebody speaking to them. You know, there's emotional content to it as well. And it's interesting to try to figure out, like, what's the circuit that's misfiring in the brain. Is it the reality testing module that's not kicking in? Is it something else that's overfunctioning? Or maybe it's different things in different people. It is probably just a category of multiple disorders, not a very discrete entity. Like, for example, not all schizophrenics have the paranoid type. You know, they have paranoia, although a lot do, of course. So it's a serious mental illness. And again, claiming that it's demonic possession and recommending that people be treated based upon that hypothesis is malfeasance. It's malpractice. It's absolutely horrific to suggest this. And the idea that this would get published as a serious peer-reviewed journal is embarrassing. It just shows that this journal is a rag. All right, I guess we have to move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items, four facts, two real, and one fake. I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yep. We're always ready.
Yeah, challenge accepted.
You guys all lost last week. I just want to point that out to you. Rebecca, out of spite, pulled out, kept me from sweeping you. All right. Here's what we got.
Out of spite. I almost went with the other one, too. I kicked myself after that show.
Yeah. Here we go. Item number one. A new study concludes that the internet is not responsible for the decline of the newspaper industry. Item number two, scientists have discovered the most ancient fox ancestor, an Arctic breed found with gnawed mammoth bones indicating the foxes were scavengers. And item number three, engineers have developed a method for creating inflatable concrete domed structures and have built the first test structure. Evan, go first.
The new study concluding the internet is not responsible for the decline of the newspaper industry. I think this one is going to turn out to be science. Maybe it has a factor. The internet is a factor in it, but not the prevailing factor, not the majority factor. It's one thing. Look, there's so many more pieces of ways to go about getting information, even beyond the internet.
Like what?
Look, there's a lot more, frankly, television channels and these sorts of things, news programs. You know, there's a whole news industry on your television, on your idiot box, right? I mean, there was a day where you only had, you know, three or four basic news related channels that you could tune into and a few others thrown in there, maybe PBS or something.
Remember that old joke about the Soviet Union? They only have two channels.
Yeah.
On one channel is government propaganda, and on the other channel is a KGB agent saying, turn back to the other channel.
Yeah.
It's called Hobson. That's
evening,
the Hobson's choice. Very nice. Very nice. So that's one example. So I think multiple factors are in play here. Next one. Scientists have discovered the most ancient fox ancestor. Ooh, an Arctic breed found with gnawed mammoth bones indicating the foxes were scavengers. I don't know about this one. It seems too perfectly kind of placed. You know, hey, we found these bones here and we found this here. And therefore, we're going to come to the conclusion that these things definitely gnawed these bones and we scavenged. I don't know. It's almost like it's set up too pretty and there's a missing peg here. Something we're not seeing. So I don't know about that one. Last one. Engineers have developed a method for creating inflatable concrete domed structures and have built the first test structure. I guess how does that work? You have a shell of concrete and I guess inside is air and you know, the concrete is still in some sort of soft stage. You put it in a skeleton of some kind to give it its rigidity and then let it sit. I guess, is that technically inflating it? I don't know about this one. I wouldn't be surprised, though, that they came up with something like this, domed structures. Well, I'm having a problem with this foxes and the mammoth bones one, and foxes, mammoth bones, that one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. You said decline of the newspaper industry. Yeah, I mean, I always assumed it was that the internet played a huge part. But the 24-hour news cycle, I think, kind of seems to coincide. I could see how that could be take a surprising chunk out of it. I mean, if you really just want the news, just, you know, there's so many channels you can go to. I'd be curious to see, though, what the ratios are that they discovered. So that was, it seems plausible. The inflatable concrete, yeah, that seems wacky. Totally. But I mean, I could imagine that they've got some weird concrete mesh or something, some sort of lightweight concrete, panels that kind of interlock once they reach a certain orientation that could kind of create a strong enough dome structure. I can kind of see that. The fox one. Yeah, there's just something that's rubbing me wrong about that. Yeah. I see images in my head of documentaries of these fox-like creatures in the Arctic and stuff. But still, there's just something that I can't quite put my finger on that might be wrong with that one. And the other ones I can kind of make an argument for. They seem a little obvious. So I'll go with the fox as well. Fiction.
All right. And Jay.
Yeah, this first one about the internet hurting the newspaper, you know, even just print industry. Absolutely. Everyone believed that. And, you know, I've heard that. This question come up actually many times, whether or not that is the case. And, you know, they talk about, you know, I work with a marketing department, even though I'm a software engineer, and I hear a lot about marketing. And, you know, things like this do come up from time to time. I can see how someone would do a study on this. I didn't read about it or don't know specifically about it, but I don't see why anyone wouldn't do a study and couldn't conclude, you know, there's lots of different things that have to do with why print and newspaper have been on the decline. And it really isn't just where people's attention is. There's an economy, I believe, that has to do with that. So, okay, so I could see that. Yes, what about the foxes? You know, I'm thinking about it. Now, we have this ancient fox ancestor that lives in the Arctic, and it had mammoth bones it was found with gnawed mammoth bones, which means that it died very soon after eating mammoth bones, which means that mammoth bones are poisonous, which means that we shouldn't bring back the mammoths. But that doesn't help me with the news item at all. Right. Okay. So it was gnawing on these bones. Therefore, it was eating bones. Now, Evan and Bob, you don't like this one, huh? I mean, see what you're saying. From the game perspective, this one is just tied up in a nice, neat little box. And there's really, I disagree. Why do I disagree? There's no reason to disagree. It must be the fake. You know, that's how my logic right now is working with that. Let's go on to the third one. Engineers have developed this method for creating inflatable concrete dome. I have no reason to believe that they didn't do that. So now it's between the newspaper thing and, you know, I have to go with you guys then, since I can't really say why I don't like the Fox one, but since you guys are both going for it, I will go for it too, because I failed last week and I don't want to be alone.
Aw, there's room for everyone.
All right, so you guys are all in agreement. So it's either going to be a very good week or a very bad week for you guys. All right, well, I guess we could take these in order. Let's start with number one. A new study concludes that the internet is not responsible for the decline of the newspaper industry. You guys all think this one is science. And this one is science.
Whoa, okay, so tell us all about it.
Yeah,
Was it TV? Was it TV?
Yeah, it's actually due to space aliens.
I knew it.
So, all right, this was a research by University of Chicago Booth School of Business Professor Matthew Genskow, and he says that the claim that the internet is what's killing journalism is based upon three false premises. And his study shows that one is that you can't make the same ad money online as you can offline, and he says that this is due to making a false comparison, that if you compare how much it costs to have like 1 hour of one eyeball's attention on your ad. You know, if you break it down that way, that actually you get more money for online ads than for print ads. In 2008, he calculated that newspapers earned $2.78 per hour of attention in print and $3.79 per hour of attention online. And by 2012, print had fallen to $1.57 while online had increased to $4.24. It's not true, basically, that you can't make money with online advertising, basically. He also said that the newspaper industry was already in significant decline between 1980 and 1995, and that this rate did not change after the internet. It continued pretty much unabated right through the internet.
Well, there you go. That's pretty solid there.
So the other assumption he said is that the web has made the advertising market more competitive, driving down rates. He said that's not true. So his analysis was, nope, the internet does not seem to be the critical factor in the decline of either ad revenue or the newspaper industry.
But he doesn't identify what it was.
It's just people are not reading. People are not reading as much.
I could buy that.
Well, that's kind of sad.
I mean, the study wasn't designed to say it, but that was the speculation. Okay, we'll go on to number two. Scientists have discovered the most ancient fox ancestor, an Arctic breed found with gnawed mammoth bones, indicating the foxes were scavengers. You guys all think this one is the fiction. Now, would you believe that scientists have discovered an extinct fox species with super sharp teeth from Tibet, which supports the out-of-Tibet hypothesis of fox origins? Did you know there was an out-of-Tibet hypothesis?
I was not aware of that.
Out-of-Tibet, wow.
Out-of-Tibet. It probably was an Arctic variety because of where it was.
Uh-oh.
And...
Say it, just say it.
Yeah, so very interesting. And...
come on, keep it going, Steve. Stretch it.
From how long ago do you think foxes go back?
Five months, 10 months,
20 million,
5.3 million years. So this species,
Jay was closer than Bob.
Lived between 5.3 and 2.6 million years ago. Vulpes kizhudingi,
right? also known as Vulpe.
Vulpe.
Right. Vulpe.
So this fox was not a scavenger, so this one is the fiction.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah. All right.
It had the teeth of a super carnivore.
Ooh.
Wow.
Why were they super?
Because, I don't know, because of all the nasty sharp teeth.
hunted probably lots of small animals.
Quite well, I'm sure.
Yeah, hypercarnivore.
Hyper. I love that word.
Yeah. Hypernova. That's such a cool thing.
Shrews, voles, squirrels, and pikas, P-I-K-A-S. You guys ever hear of that?
Pikachu!
Pikas.
Yeah, it looks like it's a cute little mouse-like creature. It looks like a half mouse, half rabbit.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, with big ears. Cute.
Yeah, but it doesn't look like it's a rodent. It's in the order Lagomorpha.
There's a website called PikaWorks, all about pikas.
They're cute.
Yeah.
So these nasty foxes ate them, apparently. But no mammoths. No mammoth bones.
No mammoth bones.
But guys, if you found like a cave, yeah, there were, you know, the bones of a meat eater in there and then the bones of another animal that had scavenger tooth marks on it. Well, that's pretty good evidence that, you know, the meat eater was a scavenger.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On the surface.
At least mm-hmm. at times.
We are able to tell that for humans. Do you know how? So like Australopithecines probably were scavengers. How do we know that?
By their teeth.
By the poop.
No.
Because
the bones we found with them have stone tool marks on top of the tooth marks of whatever killed them.
Oh, yeah. Damn, I should have known that.
They need to cover up their evidence better, I tell you.
Yeah, it's true. All right, let's go on to number three. Engineers have developed a method for creating inflatable concrete dome structures and have built the first test structure, and that, of course, is science. This was interesting. So, you know, if you're building a concrete dome with traditional methods, you have to build a structure, you know, a timber case for it to put the concrete in. With this method, they have like an inflatable balloon on the bottom. Then they create the flat concrete slabs in a very specific geometric pattern on top. And then they inflate the dome underneath it, and it locks the cement wedges into place, you know, like stones in an arch, you know, so that they support each other.
Yeah. Capstone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So when I first saw that, I'm like, oh, cool. I thought that the cement was like was still wet, you know, and then they inflated it and then it would harden in a dome, but they harden it flat and then they assemble it by inflating it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Whoa. So that's kind of.
So they build all the pieces first and they use the dome. The inflation process
to assemble
very clever.
Yeah, and then so the wedges kind of fit together, and I guess the wedges will they're flexible enough that they'll flex into that dome shape. And they say that little micro cracks occur, or little cracks occur, but it's no big deal because that would happen anyway. And then you could go back at the end of it all, and you can plaster over it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so to fix all of the whatever cracks appear.
Mm-hmm.
All the tiny cracks that they say.
And that doesn't impact the integrity then, I guess, those cracks.
They say the tiny cracks don't affect the stability of the shell, and you can plaster them over at the end. And they built a little building, but that was 2.9 meters high. So pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, inflatable concrete dome. This was the Vienna University of Technology. All right, so you guys all got me this week. Good job.
Thank you.
Now, yeah, I have to say, however, that the fiction, just the fiction, the one about the foxes, that exact fiction was submitted by a listener, David Brown. So it's David.
Oh,
very cool.
Thanks, which David.
Nice job, David Brown. Best,
which means I get to blame David for this week's news.
Yeah, and to our listeners, when you guys submit any of these fiction items, send them to Jay at the Skeptics Guide.
there's something there. Brown and Fox. David Brown Fox jumps over the lazy mammoth. There you go. I tied it all together.
That's
nice,
good work, Evan.
Nice job, Evan.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. That took me 10 seconds.
Jay, quote now.
Quote me.
Hit it.
Is that the way you address me? It's Mr. J, okay?
Dr. J.
Dr. J.
Yes.
The whirlwind jam.
This is a quote from a listener named Zamina coming from Switzerland, and the quote is, "Anyone is entitled to have his hunch, but before a hunch can attain even the modest dignity of an informed guess, it needs to be shaped by an understanding of the evidence."
Who said that?
Thomas Charles Edwards!
All right.
Thomas Charles Edwards.
T.C. Edwards.
Guy has three first names.
He's a emeritus fellow.
Emeritus.
Emeritus fellow, formerly professor of Celtic at Oxford University.
He's saying hunches are nice, but evidence is what really is important.
Well, guys, we're going to be at TAM in a few weeks.
Yep. Oh, boy.
Las Vegas South Point Hotel.
It's coming up quick. I can't wait.
July 11th to 13th. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. Bill Nye, the science guy, is going to be there.
Yo, Billy.
Bill.
We got to interview him again.
He's always great.
Yeah, awesome guy. Bow tie and all.
If you haven't registered for the conference yet, don't forget to use the SGU TAM 2014 registration code to get your $25 discount and also sign up for the SGU dinner. And don't forget that if you become a premium member of the SGU, that you get access to premium content. We have 28 pieces of premium content up right now.
There you go.
Listen to hours of extra content
and more to come.
Hey, Steve, I have an announcement.
Yeah.
It's two quickie announcements. This is the first ever Brisbane Skeptic Camp, and it's since actually 2009. The event will be held on Saturday the 19th on July 2014. It is completely free and open. The event will feature 12 local skeptics, Loretta Moran of Friends in Science and Medicine, and John Cook. The event will also feature a live podcast performance of Skeptically Challenged, and I was recently on this podcast with George Rabb, and this is going live. By the time you hear this, it'll be up. It's www.brisskepticamp.org.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining me this week.
Sure, Steve.
Thanks, Doctor.
We love you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.